Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. Alexis de Tocqueville made a lasting contribution to our understanding of American society when he wrote Democracy in America. But in one important particular, de Tocqueville's eloquence may have failed to capture a central truth about this country. With his gift for the evocative generalization and his interest in ideal types, he may have promoted a notion of American democracy as far more unified and coherent than it is or could be. The real truth of this rich democratic tradition encompasses a lot more contention, confrontation, and argument than de Tocqueville allowed for. And this disorderliness was as much a feature of the 1812-1861 era as it is of our own. My guest is Sean Wilentz, professor of history at Princeton University and a current fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Sean, welcome to Dialogue.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Sean. Let's go right to the beginning of this, Sean, because I think it's an article of faith for most of us, myself, until I've had the advantage of reading things you've written, that this country underwent a sort of vast and uniformly progressive expansion of democracy between the War of 1812 and the Civil War. Now, given that, in fact, great numbers of white males, European-descended males, were enfranchised, is there another side of this story as well for that same period, for other classes, genders, and groups?
Oh, there certainly is. There's no question that there's a great deal of truth to the general impression that America did undergo a tremendous expansion both of commerce and of democratic possibilities in the era after the War of 1812. We had failed to lose that war. We had reestablished the Republic. We were our own nation, and we were going to develop as a nation. However, there are lots of ironies to that story, and I think the story isn't really as fully as understood as it should be without taking those into account.
What are some of those ironies?
Well, from the start, democratization for white men accompanied in many places a restriction of political rights for other people. In the North, for example, expansion of the suffrage for propertyless men, white men, went hand in hand with restriction of political rights for blacks, for free blacks. At the same time, in the few places, the one place really where women had the right to vote in New Jersey, those rights were restricted as well in this period, well, just before 1812. So this is not a uniform process.
Right.
More interesting to me is the ways in which different types of democracies developed in the United States. Here's where Tocqueville got a sense of some of the fissures and cracks, but did not fully appreciate it because he was always trying to figure out this solitary thing, democracy.
Yeah.
In fact, it's fairly clear to me that in the North and the South, very distinct forms of democracy developed.
We're going to talk about those regional differences and notions of democracy, Sean, to which you devoted so much attention. But what's the significance of these ironies that you've just described? I mean, the fact that one group would advance, but others would essentially recede in their rights in the same period.
Yeah, the question comes down to who are the people? The Constitution begins with the proposition, we the people of the United States, that there is this people out there in which sovereignty is supposed to be invested. There is still a very powerful idea, however, that to be a true citizen involved having a certain kind of independence. What do we mean by independence? Independence means being able to come to one's own decisions without reference to another person, without reference to an employer, without reference to a patriarch, without reference to an aristocrat. Now, in the 19th century, it's fairly clear that people who had previously been deemed dependent were pressing for their rights to be considered full citizens.
Right.
However, it raised all sorts of questions about where you now redraw the line. John Adams, in fact, says at one point, very early on in 1776 or so, that if the idea of popular sovereignty were to be taken to its extreme, then everybody, every rational adult, would have political rights. That worried John Adams a great deal. And the fact was, in the 19th century, that the line is not abolished, the line is simply redrawn.
Is it a question of who should be enfranchised?
Who should be enfranchised? Who should have a full-throated participant
Right.
in political affairs? Now, there are further ironies down the line. We'll get to those in a sec. In the early 19th century, it still remained the case that, for women, for example, that by law, women were still, married women were under a state of coverture, that basically they were considered to be political extensions of their husbands, or rather their husbands covered them in the public realm. The idea of giving full independent rights to women was raised by a few very early on, Abigail Adams very famously in 1776, but for most of the period, the idea was that women were still dependent creatures. They did not have that independence. The case of free blacks in the North is more complicated. There, it's as much a political machination as anything else. Free black voters in the North tended to go Federalist in the early 19th century for complicated reasons, and the process of democratization involved a great deal of political jockeying. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, people who were pushing for democratization very often were not Federalists, and they were very happy to get that black Federalist vote, small but potentially significant as it was, out of the way. Mm-hmm. So there was a process whereby the standards for participation for blacks were raised higher and higher. That also played in, however, quite clearly to ideas that blacks were somehow a dependent people, a special people, as one delegate at the New York State Constitutional Convention put it in 1821, a peculiar people that could not really attain the kind of mental independence
right.
to enable them to be citizens.
So at the core of it, Sean, is it these groups of dependent peoples, women and blacks, and their attempts or the argument about them becoming independent
mm-hmm.
that really is at the core of the argument that's undergoing
precisely
between 1812 and 1861.
Precisely. Although one should not overestimate the extent to which there was a real debate about those issues in this period. The fact was, until the 1840s, most famously 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention, there really wasn't much of a movement
right.
to press for women's suffrage rights. Mm-hmm. Likewise, although there are groups of free blacks in the North who are very angry, most of their energies are poured into abolitionist activity rather than enfranchisement activity. They're much more concerned about the larger issue
right.
facing blacks in America at that point, which was slavery. So one should not overestimate that. One can go back and do so.
Mm-hmm.
There's some very interesting beginnings. It's really only after the Civil War that those issues crack open.
I think it's appropriate now to introduce the regional dimension of this question. I mean, what distinctions can you draw between the North and South on the discussion of these issues at that time?
I mean, if you look at democratization in particular, you can see quite clearly that there are new constitutional developments that are fairly similar between the North and the South. And there is an expansion of the suffrage for white men in the South, just as there is in the North. All sorts of changes, with the one exception of the state of South Carolina, which remains, you know, the most aristocratic state in the nation, right? Up to 1860, but holding that aside. At the same time, however, political institutions, the way that politics actually worked day to day, North and South, had very different meanings and dimensions. In the South, there are all sorts of ways in which the structure of politics is geared to making sure that the slavery issue will never arise as a bone of contention. You can see that in a lot of different ways, in the ways that local office holding was structured, the rules and codes about who could be a sheriff or a justice of the peace, very important offices in the lower South, the way that political campaigns were conducted. In all of these ways, there was fractious political debate within the South, but not over the issue of slavery.
One quick question on that.
Mm-hmm.
Would that kind of sort of Southern approach to democratization be also very class-based? I mean, I get a sense of the class that was most interested in having things structured that way. That is the landholding.
There was a class dimension. I mean, there was a fight, usually sub-regional as well as class. It would be the backcountry yeoman farmers, non-slaveholding farmers, who wanted to increase not so much suffrage but representation. The state of Virginia is a good example. There are long political battles about getting full representation for the, in the case of Virginia, the western, small, non-slaveholding regions. And there are these fights. By the very late 1840s, 1850s, a number of previously conservative types in the South began to realize that to enfranchise the poorer whites was to bring them into, in effect, a kind of solidarity on the slavery issue. In fact, one Henry Wise from Virginia states quite explicitly in the 1850s that in Virginia, white men will be enfranchised precisely to provide, you know, a common front against the North on the slavery issue. So a distinctive Southern slave democracy, slaveholder's democracy, if you will, develops, which is quite different from the North,
right,
where no one class of property men holds power, holds sway. It's much more fragmented. There are many more possibilities. It also has to do with lines of communication and differences in communication, a lot of reasons for it.
Right.
But there's a much more fluid kind of politics in the North, which allows for, you know, much more ferment.
What about my perception, and maybe totally wrong-headed, Sean, of a, for lack of a better expression, a professionalization of politics in the North? I suppose I'm thinking of things like, you know, Tammany Hall and that kind of the urban structure of Northern politics and the influence of the labor class and, mm-hmm. and quite frankly, perhaps the existence of corruption as well mm-hmm. in Northern politics.
Excellent point, which it's true in the South as well. I mean, there are party developments, although parties develop much more slowly because you do not have the cities that you do in the South. You don't have quite those founts of communication and influence. But parties are absolutely essential. And in fact, if you want to talk about classes, it's the development of a class that few have taken account of, the political class, a mm-hmm. class of people who dedicate themselves. They're usually lawyers, local insiders, men often of very humble birth, a class of people that did not exist in the 18th century, who dedicate themselves to political advancement for the good of their party. That is a group of people that really does begin to develop out of the Revolution, but quite clearly after 1815. Men like Martin Van Buren in the North, but also in the South, equivalents, sometimes newspaper editors, his good buddy Thomas Ritchie, Van Buren's good friend Thomas Ritchie, editor of the Richmond Inquirer, had a real sense of this as well. So parties develop as the centerpiece for political loyalty, but also for the distribution of patronage. Now, whenever one talks about patronage, one talks about corruption.
Exactly. Inevitably.
Inevitably. However, the idea that this kind of patronage was legitimate was something that was very powerful as well.
Right.
To the victor belongs the spoils. To a man like Van Buren, unlike the founding fathers, parties were absolutely necessary to keep political coherence.
Sean, let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Sean Wilentz, professor of history at Princeton University and a current fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Sean, a couple of philosophical questions. We often hear used the phrase, the rise of American democracy, particularly ascribed to this period. How should we understand that phrase? I mean, what does, given what you've said about what was going on then, what does that phrase really mean?
Well, I think that there's no question that something happened in the United States from roughly 1776 on. That was part of probably the most profound political event in modern times, which is the invention of the idea as well as the reality that sovereignty and government ought to be invested in the people, in ordinary individual people, citizens. That's an idea that was extraordinary in its time. I mean, for millennia, go back to Plato. Mm-hmm. The idea was that there was a very clear hierarchy of people, that the masses of people were fit for nothing much more important or responsible than the drudgery of beasts. Suddenly, this idea breaks out. It had broken out in the 17th century in England a little bit, but it was pretty quickly suppressed. You see bits and pieces of it among the sectarians in New England in the 17th century. But really, only with the American Revolution, I think, mm-hmm. do you see that idea come to the fore with an extraordinary power.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens thereafter, I think, is probably the most important political event or political development in the history of the modern world. So to talk about the rise of American democracy is a very important thing.
And it is, in a sense, to follow up on that question and that very good answer, is that, in a sense, what we're all about? I mean, continuing that debate, and I get a sense, continuing it on the basis of inclusion, you know, who are these individuals? Who are the people who have these rights? I mean, that the sort of debate from that time to this has ultimately been variants of that question. You know, who is,
yes,
women, minorities, etc.
Yes, who is in, who is out?
Who's up? Yeah.
What institutions are appropriate? regional questions, states' rights. That was an idea that has taken on very clear connotations about race, but nevertheless, there's also a philosophical proposition of how, where government should be primarily located, at the federal centralized level or at local levels. Democracy in itself, the proposition of popular sovereignty in itself, doesn't tell you very much.
Right.
It tells you that certain things will not be the case. We will not have kings. We will not have aristocrats. We will have some form of popular government. But beyond that, nothing is settled. That's why I've said in this piece that I've just written for the Quarterly that democracy in America is not an ideal, it's an argument. It's something that we're always arguing over. In a sense, we're still arguing the results of the American Revolution. Although it should be remembered that even at the end of the Revolution, with the ratification of the Constitution, we still had a long way to go to establishing the proposition of popular government as, say, for example, the Jacksonian generation would understand it.
Without perhaps further examples of lethal disagreement in periods after 1865, is the argument, as it's continued over time, also been linked to a great crises, for example, banking crises and economic crises? I mean, does it get more, does it change character as we go through into those phases where we're all kind of faced with a great national emergency?
It does, although, I mean, the argument will take on different dimensions. First, let me say that I do think that the pattern you see before the Civil War, although it changes tremendously, still reappears, this question of economics and then race and racial justice. And you see that running through right into our own time. There are times of crises, however, where the United States has been extremely lucky, I think. In the case of the Great Depression, for example, it was by no means evident that someone like Franklin Delano Roosevelt would come along, not so much to save the economy, but at least to pull some sense of national identity together. It's not to say that Roosevelt was completely beloved, far from it. A famous cartoon in the New Yorker from back in the 30s of Peter Arno, great cartoonist, of you know, some well-dressed men and matrons, and one turns to the other and says, "Let's go down to the Trans-Lux and boo Roosevelt." Roosevelt was deeply hated for what he did. Nevertheless,
traitor to his class,
mm-hmm. exactly. Yet he managed to provide a kind of national cohesion, which was by no means guaranteed. So there are points at which the United States has been extremely fortunate in its leaders and so on. But nevertheless, we should not fool ourselves into thinking that the existence of such people has somehow covered over, papered over, or solved the basic conflicts that still divide us as a nation.
And do I take it from you, Sean, that at least two of those basic conflicts, those basic themes, continue to be economic organization mm-hmm. and, say, questions of inclusiveness, civil rights, human rights, etc.? I mean,
exactly.
How our population is treated.
You look at the politics of today. I mean, what are we talking about, essentially? Should the state, this federal government, be a surplus as we've just accrued? What should they be used for? Should we cut taxes? Should we not cut taxes? That is, in a sense, an argument over how economic power should be organized in a democracy. Likewise, with regard to race and racial justice, we've come a long, long way in the last 30 years, a tremendously long way. But there are still the legacies of those old injustices remain with us, the realities of them, but also the legacies of them. How is America going to adjust to a post-segregated world? What does integration mean? Integration, racial integration, was a word 30 years ago that was almost as uncontroversial as democracy. Yet you hear today a great deal of debate over whether integration is a good or a bad thing. I happen to be a deep integrationist and believe in it to the depths of my soul, but that's an argument that you have to have. It is not self-evident. So we're still dealing with these questions, and they all come back to my mind, what is democracy?
Yeah.
Everybody will say, "I'm doing this because I believe in democracy." I can remember in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan and Coretta Scott King were both great champions of democracy, yet they meant very different things by it.
Exactly. Mm.
So that's the country we've got, it seems to me, not a country where everybody's simply going off and doing his or her own thing. We have the power to do that. But we're also a country that has to constantly come to terms with what kind of a nation we want to be.
I think that's very well said, Sean. Let me ask you this question, since you've brought us so neatly into our own day and shown us how this question persists, how this is, well, the question itself is part of the definition of being an American, I think, or being part of this society. But how is it affected by interest group politics? What we see today, what some call, Hugh Heckelman, for example, calls hyper-democracy, that is sort of the organization of subsets of the question, perhaps, advanced by lobbying groups, by other forms of sort of sophisticated, in some cases, electronic polling and that kind of thing. How does all of that factor into this ongoing debate?
Oh, it's changed. The institutional terrain in which politics is conducted has changed enormously in the last 30 years. In part, it's been a measure of the decline of party, that thing that was invented back in the 1820s as the focus for people's political attention. Political parties really have declined. They've declined for a lot of reasons. They've declined in part because they were attacked from within. There was a feeling back in the 1960s that parties were a bad thing. The Democratic Party in particular reformed itself. Then it reformed itself back again. But it's unclear what kind of meaning a party has going into the 21st century. Into the breach has stepped a cavalcade. When we say interests, there are always interests in American politics, but they're extremely well-funded, extremely sophisticated groups that try and not simply get their way. They're not simply lobbyists. They've learned how important it is to have control over the general perception of reality. It seems odd, but the fact is there's been a great fight, ideological fight, over what how, in fact, to use an example from the title of a book by one of these ideologues, Jude Winiski, How the World Works. Now, if you take it for granted, for example, that free markets are the way, free markets are a state of nature, that any interference with free markets is necessarily undoing nature, you're going to come out with one position. If you have a different position, that government really is necessary to help keep the markets going along, that without government, markets are either oppressive or spin out of control, you're going to take another view. There's been a tremendous ideological battle, but it's been funded by these particular groups. Mm-hmm. You then get to the question of the more conventional lobbying, and there we have another set of problems. Money has always been the mother's milk of politics. Let's not deceive ourselves and think that money wasn't there. Money was always there. However, today the costs, I mean, this is a cliche, but it's important to note that the costs of running campaigns have just blown up, have grown astronomical, have soared. And so money is needed on a constant basis, and who's going to provide it? It's not going to be the ordinary you and me. We can all check off our little thing on the tax form and say we're going to help fund things, but publicly funded campaigns are not going to be able to overcome the vast amounts of money that private interests and private corporations can put into political campaigns. So we have seen a real change.
So what we have is this ongoing argument, this continual debate about what democracy means, but now, as you've just described, intensely complicated by these various layerings of interest groups, lobbying groups, and you've made, I think, a very neat distinction between the two of them and
yes.
the influence of money. So it's the same thing, but just perhaps a lot more complicated.
More complicated, but don't think that the new is going to completely undo what existed. We've seen that, I think, in the last 6 months, actually. Mm-hmm. And there were great interest groups out there pushing a particular issue around the impeachment of President Clinton. Yet, the public remained in its place. It didn't become more anti-impeachment. It did not become more pro-impeachment. The public made up its mind for its own reasons, and there are many reasons for it, I assume, but part of it was an understanding of how American politics should work, what the Constitution says, what, in fact, American democracy is about. So all of the money in the world, all of the lobbying in the world, cannot necessarily, in the final analysis, be enough to change things. There's something that I find rather optimistic about that. Mm-hmm. I find rather something about that that I find heartening, hopeful.
Well, let me probe that for the concluding question of this conversation. I think mm-hmm. you've positioned us admirably to do that very thing. What is that thing? Because it strikes me as I listen to you that there is a legacy that we enjoy now derived from the early republic. Mm-hmm. And to use a, I hope not too trite phrase, perhaps it is that we are a work in progress, but committed to sort of a basic democratic ideal we're constantly trying to define. But that's a lot of verbiage. I'd love to get your answer. You've talked about the past, you've talked about the present. How will this legacy take us into the future? What is it at its core?
That's a very big question, George. I think at its core is the idea that of our two ideas. One is that we are a nation of laws, and that the rule of law, as summarized in the Constitution above all, must be respected if we are to advance as a nation. Now, we can argue back and forth about that, but we have a sheet anchor, a political sheet anchor, which is the Constitution. And I think, especially recently, we've seen that operate very clearly. The other is that American politics ought to be conducted in such a way that it neither, well, this is how it's trite, so it won't go very far. There's a sheet anchor of the Constitution that we cannot really deviate from. But I think there's also an idea that the idea of popular sovereignty oughtn't to be either oppressive of minorities, but neither ought it to be a dead letter. That the purpose of an American democracy is really to help each individual attain his or her best life, pursue happiness, as Thomas Jefferson put it. We won't all be the same. We're not going to come out equal. Equal outcomes is not what we're getting at. It's the opportunity to do so. The government is there to enhance that equal opportunity with the understanding that we can't all make it on our own. That, I think, is a kind of idea that is shared across all of these boundaries. And again, in the final analysis, even when we fight and scream and kick, we can agree about that, or we have been able to agree about that, with one really great exception, and that was slavery, an issue about which there could be no compromise ultimately, because there we were talking about an element of human dignity which could not be compromised away.
Sean Wilentz, let me thank you for a conversation that was not only enlightening but inspiring. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you, George. It was a real pleasure.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Sean Wilentz, professor of history at Princeton University and a current fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Kristen Hunter. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.
PRI, Public Radio International.